Dave and Dijanovic, your morning companions for talk, analysis, and key perspectives on Utah's biggest stories on KSL News Radio.
We're just getting word right now on the situation in Baltimore where the bridge collapsed after that cargo ship crashed into it, that divers are now going back into the water. I'd heard earlier that they'd called off the search for, they believe, all those six construction workers who fell from the bridge. But now we're getting reports that they're going back into the water. So we'll keep an update on that.
And we learned that Utah trains at depths of up to 125 feet. Mm. This is about 40 to 60 feet that they're searching in Baltimore. It's 9:07. It's time for the launch.
Sequence engaged.
And here are three things that Debbie wants you to know.
Countdown three.
We're going to talk about Idaho today. Because the state's trying to do some damage control after Utah women's basketball coach went public with racial hate crimes. She says chased her team from their Coeur d'Alene, Idaho hotel during March Madness that happened last week. Well, now Coeur d'Alene officials are falling all over themselves to issue apologies, and they did so during a news conference yesterday. But in a weird, uncomfortable twist, the news conference gets disrupted and then gets cut short because a far-right activist shows up and starts shouting questions at officials.
This is a press conference?
It's press with the media, not with the general public.
I'm in the media.
No, well, who are you with? Who are you with?
It doesn't matter.
Yes, it does. You're out of order.
If you don't want to tell which news organization you're with, it's probably because it's a shady news organization. But yeah, there's a real problem right now for Idaho. They're being labeled as racist, and this is a major problem that they have to address because this was a terrible experience for the University of Utah women's basketball team when it should have been the best time of year.
Countdown.
We're continuing our in-depth housing series this morning at 10:35 with this growing trend. Dave, I found it online. There's all kinds of different stories about it. It's helping homeowners pay their expensive mortgages. It's called house hacking. Have you heard of it? I guess the question would be, would you rent a room? Collect a few hundred dollars a month. Would you rent a room to a perfect stranger to help afford your pricey mortgage? It is happening all over the Wasatch Front. We started looking into it, and sure enough, lots of rooms being rented out. So we're going to look into how much homeowners can earn from this, and also the downside besides having a perfect stranger in the bedroom next door to your bedroom.
One of my best friends was a stranger. Now, this was in college when it's kind of accepted that you just move in with strangers and you make it work. My daughter had kind of a crazy roommate. It happens. It's a little bit luck of the draw, but I think we were totally fine with it in our early 20s, and it worked because it worked financially. Why doesn't the same math work now? I think you're going to show, Debbie, that it does.
Launch countdown one.
I could not stop laughing when I heard this report come out this morning about Utah, the most affordable state to live in, you know, all of the country, in all of America. What? Yeah, $3.53 a gallon for gas right now, hundreds of dollars for groceries. We just talked a few days ago about the astronomical price of homes in this state. But yep, USA Today says Utah is actually the most affordable state in all of America. Well, for me, the math ain't mathin'.
I love that. The math ain't mathin'.
No.
It's so true. It feels that way.
Whose calculator because, are they using?
Well, Debbie, we live in this little bubble, and we never want to leave our bubble, and we want to be angry because everything inside of our bubble is not perfect. Do you not remember paying $7 a gallon for gas in California? Because I do. My son was paying $5 for a gallon of milk in Alaska. That was for the cheap stuff, by the way. Important to look outside of the bubble. And you know what? After all, maybe Utah isn't so bad.
Dave and Jen. Dujanovic.
The launch.
Commence.
Dave and Dujanovic.
Dave and Dujanovic.
Special coverage of the top local story.
I have a feeling I am not alone, though, Dave. I think a lot of people are laughing at this headline in USA Today that says that Utah is the most affordable. We're number one. Most affordable states in the nation to live. I cannot imagine what numbers they were using on their calculator back there at USA Today to come up with this, because I don't buy it.
Yeah, sometimes the math is a little fuzzy in these reports, but they break it down. They say, okay, let's look at the top five basic expenses. Let's look at home ownership, all those costs, insurance, property taxes, all of that stuff. Groceries, healthcare, income tax, and gas. Those were the five things that they looked at, and do your little calculator. Huh? Utah, number one.
Okay, let's break it down. Home ownership costs, they're out of control. Most first-time home buyers can't afford a first-time home, so they have to rent. Rental costs, out of control. What, $1,800, $2,000 a month? Maybe that includes utilities, maybe it doesn't. And when it comes to healthcare costs, that depends on what disease you have, what disease you got stuck with. It doesn't, you know, I mean, sometimes it can cost a couple hundred dollars a year to go to the doctor. And so for some people, it is thousands and thousands.
Yes.
So that just seems just weird to me. And then income tax, okay, maybe state tax is a little bit lower, but it ain't free. In other states, there's no income tax. And then gasoline. A lot of times you and I sit here and report that we're some of the highest gas prices in the West, and we can't figure out why.
Yeah, what's so interesting about this, and this is why I think I really like this article, is it takes a 30,000-foot view. It really looks from high above and brings in all the other states and measures apples to apples and oranges to oranges. And okay, well, we might be a little higher in home costs here, but we're far cheaper in healthcare costs, or groceries are more affordable here. So you want to know, okay, does it even out? And overall, what does it look like? And Utah comes out on top. I will say this, Deb, I was as surprised as you are. But as we start diving in and you start looking around, there's one key right here. It's all about what you're paying compared to what you're earning. Mm. And sure, all those things that you mentioned, they can be very expensive. But the fact that we make a good median salary here in Utah changes the math. We make good money so we can afford to spend more.
Who are you kidding? We make good money.
We make good
money. Come on. Our listeners are like, they got to be rolling your eyeballs right now, right? I mean, you're making good money.
You're going to be surprised at how much people are making here in Utah.
Well, we just reported this the other day. It's around $60,000 a year. You know, so okay, we'll look and see what USA Today suggests that we're earning here in Utah. But for me, the math still ain't mathing. So we'll get our certified financial planner, Shane Stewart, on the line next to help walk us through this math. Maybe he could make us bite on this USA Today article and lean into it, which says Utah's number one state in the nation, most affordable state in the nation. There's no way.
Dave and Dujanovic.
Look, this USA Today article had me laughing out loud as I was listening to it this morning. Of course, Utah's morning news was breaking it down. And once they broke it down, it started to make a little bit of sense to me. But USA Today puts Utah as the most affordable state in all of America to live. And I need to hear the math for myself, Dave, because this ain't mathing for me.
The key is we make a good living in Utah.
Which I laugh at.
Why do you laugh at that?
Because I think there's a lot of people who are struggling.
Oh,
they're living
sure.
paycheck to paycheck. They can't afford the little extras. They can't even afford a vacation. So when I hear, oh, we make a good living, who?
This is going to shock you. The number they're reporting is $89,000 a year is the median income in Utah. $89,000. What's your reaction?
No way.
It seems high.
It seems way high. It's certainly, at least to me, $30,000, $40,000 a year higher than many people I know who they're living paycheck to paycheck. So USA Today, I'm sure they crunched the numbers and they collected the data. But data is different than how we feel and what is actually happening. So they might look at some data sets, but to me, numbers are numbing. It's just how people are actually experiencing their lives. And there's high credit card debt in Utah. We just talked a couple of days ago that we're the third highest priced housing market in the entire nation behind Hawaii and California. Then comes Utah. So I'm just having some real heartburn with this.
There's a couple things I think that are important to remember is sometimes, and this matters, it's going to sound kind of wonky and mathy, but you say the math doesn't math. The median income means they throw out the high and low scores, so to speak, and they just look at what do most people make kind of in the meaty part of the curve. And that's an important number because you're right. There are people that are making $20,000, $30,000 a year and just scraping by. There's also multimillionaires. We don't want to just average that all together, and sometimes that's mm-hmm. what we do. We take, you know, you're making 20, you're making 30, and this guy makes 50 million, and then we average them all together. The median, so this $89,000 says half of Utah makes over $89,000, and half of Utah makes under $89,000. So yeah, you're absolutely right. There's a lot of people that are nowhere near $90,000 a year, but half are above that. So life is pretty good.
Shane Stewart, certified financial planner with DMBA. Shane, Dave just tried to explain it to me why USA Today named Utah number one most affordable state in all of the country. I don't buy it. Do the math. Do the math.
The math is all subjective, right? It's one of those things where we look at median income right around 90,000, which is true. But the average income, which is different, in Utah is just under 50,000. That might make you feel a little better, Debbie, that maybe is a more real number. And median income just simply means if there were only three people in the state of Utah, Dave, Debbie, and Shane, Shane makes 10,000, Debbie makes 75,000, and Dave makes 100,000. Well, the median income is 75. It's the person in the middle. So to Dave's point, half are making more and half are making less, but the average income is everyone in the state of Utah lumped together and then divided by the number of people. The average income number being around 50,000 is much less than 90,000. And so to Dave's point, it's not only half the state is living on less than 89,000, they're living on a lot less than 89,000 to keep that average down. And so there's a big divide there in average income.
And average income has its own problems. If you, me, and Debbie were with Elon Musk, our average net worth would be $60 billion.
Exactly. Yep. Right? The numbers are really difficult. And so to that point, Dave, I think it's really hard to just look at these numbers and make one definitive suggestion of how things are going. It really depends on even what the individual wants, what the individual defines as making it or not. What is their housing situation, kind of car they drive is very difficult to peg.
Shane Stewart, a certified financial planner with DMBA, on the line with us live right now. USA Today has named Utah the most affordable place to live in the entire nation. What do you see? What do you think as a certified financial planner? I just don't see it as Utah being the most affordable place. I mean, you look at all of the states across the nation and you look at places in the Midwest where you can buy a home for half the price you can buy it here. I just don't see it. But what do you see as a certified financial planner?
Yeah, many times it doesn't feel that way just because, you know, folks who are scraping by. A lot of folks are you know, scraping by with rent or a mortgage, with food, et cetera. There are some favorable things in Utah. However, Utah's a pretty well-run state as far as our government goes, meaning they keep the tax rates low. Whenever there's high inflation or high unemployment in the country. It's usually a little less, usually a little better in the state of Utah. And so we usually have better employment rates, better inflation rates. And so there are those things that do favor Utah. There's a lot of numbers that go into this, these statistics that they're showing. And so there are some really favorable things from Utah. But again, to the point we made about median income, the reason it doesn't feel like everybody's doing, because about half the entire state are living on less than that median income, and yeah, in some cases, much less.
Another thing, Debbie, you talk about how expensive homes are and trying to get in, especially if it's a first home. There are a lot of people that have a mortgage right now. They didn't buy at the peak of the market, that they have a good interest rate. And I think that certainly plays into our favor right now as well.
Yeah. And there are steps being taken to help with affordable housing and those kind of things. And I hope those programs run well. They're new, they're untested, but they're hopefully there are some things that help this cyclical idea of inflation and affordable housing to come back down to earth and make it better for those who are below the median.
Shane Stewart, thank you for joining us, certified financial planner with DMBA.
So you were saying earlier, Dave, in the show that we're in a bubble and sometimes we like to bash things in the bubble.
Yeah.
What do you mean by that?
Okay, I think because we only know what is immediately around us. We only know what it's like to pay gas prices in Utah. You know, we're not long haul truckers. You know, we're not buying gas all across the country. So we know what groceries cost here. We know what gas costs here. We don't have a really good comparison about what it's like to pay a rent in San Francisco, which is far more expensive than it is in Salt Lake. So we kind of live in this bubble where we just want to complain and feel bad about ourselves and have a pity party when there are far worse places in this country for healthcare, for groceries, for gasoline, for home prices. And if you take it all into account, that's what this article is saying, that overall, take it all into account, Utah's doing great.
Do you side with Dave? Is this just a pity party? 801-575-TALK, 801-575-TALK. Personally, I don't feel like Utah deserves to be number one in all of the nation as the most affordable place to live. I think this article is laughable. So do you side with Dave or do you side with me? 801-575-TALK. Looking forward to your live phone calls next.
Dave and Dejanovic, your morning companions for talk, analysis, and key perspectives on Utah's biggest stories on KSL News Radio.
Do you agree with the USA Today report? The article that says Utah is the most affordable place to live in all of America? We're taking your live phone calls. 801-575-TALK. Again, 801-575-TALK.
Team Dave says, absolutely. I can see it. Quite honestly, I don't know, because I love Utah, I'm attached, love affair, whatever you want to call it. I love Utah. I think it's, you know, the best state around. That's why I've lived here my entire life. I think they make a pretty compelling case of why Utah is the most affordable. That's not to say things aren't expensive in Utah. I will absolutely grant you that. Homes, gas, groceries, all of that stuff feels very expensive. But comparatively speaking, compared to other states around us, compared to what we actually make, what our incomes are, overall, I think they make a compelling case that Utah is the most affordable in the nation.
I think that you are up in the night.
Cuckoo bananas.
Yeah. There's just no way. There's just no way that our listeners are listening to you say that and go, yeah, you know what? That Dave is right. I don't feel underwater financially at all. This is a great place to live when it comes to my finances. Homes are affordable here? Not. Gas prices are super cheap? Not. So often we cover stories that gas prices are some of the highest in the West in Utah. You know, cars cost the same here as they do in other states, but sometimes we have to pay more for a car because we need all-wheel or four-wheel drive. We need tires more often because of our roads. And then they tell us to buy summer and winter tires. Okay, well, that's just another $1,000 nobody has sitting around. So 801-575-TALK is the number to call. You can also head over to our KSL News Radio Facebook page. It is lit up with comments of people weighing in. And here's the question. According to USA Today, Utah is the most affordable state to live in. Do you agree with that? We'll get to some of your comments in just a moment.
So for comparison, and this is really where it's crucial, they laid out the national cost of living. So they looked at five different things. They looked at your taxes, home, groceries, health care, and then gasoline. So those are the five biggies. Nationally, homeowner costs are about $1,800 per month. So does that feel high or low here in Utah? Well, if $1,800 doesn't even start, if you're trying to buy a new home, if you're a first-time home buyer here, you never get anything for $1,800.
So maybe what USA Today looked at was homeowners who are currently in a home and probably bought years ago when homes, the average price of a home wasn't $533,000.
Yeah. In fact, just 10 years ago, it was my house was half of that. It was worth probably $250,000, $270,000. Now it's over $500,000. Well, I'm not paying $500,000. I bought my house 20 years ago. So I have a 3.5% interest rate. So it's going great for me. And there's a lot of people in Utah that are in that situation where they have an existing home mortgage. They have a good interest rate. Not to discount what people are going through right now if you're a first-time home buyer, but that's not the majority of Utah.
Here's what USA Today says about Utah as being the most affordable state to live in. Our total cost of living every year is about $56,000. The median income, they say, is almost $90,000. Behind Utah, in the number two spot, is Tennessee. Number three is Arizona. Then comes Nevada, and then the state of Washington. Did they look in Seattle? Because I've felt for years that homes in Seattle are highly unaffordable and very pricey, not just recently either, going back quite a number of years. When I was looking around at moving out of state, it's like Seattle, I can't afford to live there. It's like felt like San Francisco. Let's get to our comments on our Facebook page. Also, the phone calls as well. 801-575-TALK, the number to call. Facebook. We posted this on our KSL News Radio Facebook page. We have way more than 100 comments. I can't get through all of them. And Kristen says, 2 days ago, I read news articles that we were the most unaffordable, only behind California and Hawaii. What Kristen's talking about is the coverage that we did here at KSL News Radio with housing costs. Utah is number three in the nation for most expensive housing. So we're feeling conflicted by the information that's being put out.
Yeah, the key there is what housing is right now. What this article looks like, what we're looking at right now, takes into account, you know, the past 30, 40, 50 years, or whatever, the people are either homeowners or they have a good interest rate. That one that you're referencing is just the snapshot into today.
Joseph, what do you think? Utah, the most affordable place to live in the nation?
Nope, it's not.
Talk about it. Give us
it's
more.
Not at all.
How so?
I've been renting all my, ever since I can remember, I've been renting, and even the rent's high. It's crazy. And not to add upon the problem, there's the gas. Gas prices are starting to be outrageous again.
Yep.
And food prices and it's just like you can hardly even get a breather from all the little things added to what a normal person has to go through, not counting any other additional bills they might have to pay to make a living.
Thank you so much, Joseph. I feel it. I know it, and it's difficult because also rent prices keep going up, and that's hard to keep up with. Justin, You feel like Utah's the most affordable place in the nation?
It's probably one of the worst affordable, but at the same time, it's probably the most attractive just because there's so much demand.
Well, this is what I worry about with this article. After I stopped laughing at this USA Today report, I thought, oh my goodness, I hope people all over the nation don't read this and start moving here. Because
if they start looking, they'll notice that those prices are higher, like you were saying.
Hopefully, because you start looking at the housing situation in Utah, we don't have enough supply here as it is.
True.
I mean, the governor is already calling on home builders to start building, 35,000 new starter homes by 2028. So we start getting more people here who look at headlines like this, thinking that they're going to save all kinds of money by moving here. I mean, I guess unless you're living in California, maybe that is the case, but it's not, in my view, affordable here.
And this may look much different 5 or 10 years from now. But I look at this, and I will say this. If the median income is $90,000 a year here in Utah, and that half of Utah is making more than $90,000, that is incredible, right? That probably shocked me more than anything, that half of Utah is making over $90,000. Now, if you're making under $90,000, of course, all this math doesn't math, as you were saying, Debbie. It just, you're living paycheck to paycheck, but not that $90,000 makes you wealthy, but it does surprise me that half of Utah, you know, if you're looking through a crowd, you could say, well, half of you are making over $90,000. That surprised me.
A man arrested for terrorizing numerous women all over the Wasatch Front, accused of running them down and then leaving the scene. Of course, he's in custody. He will appear in court today. But KSL Television's Shara Park found something very concerning about the hit-and-run incidents and is asking this question. What took police so long to track down a suspect who'd been running over women allegedly since August? She joins the show next.
Dave and Dejanovic. The D2 follow-up report. We stay connected to important stories to give you the latest.
We're going to talk about this suspect who is going to be in court today. He's been arrested for allegedly terrorizing women all over the Wasatch Front, Salt Lake City and in Sandy, by running them down with his car, according to police and according to the district attorney, Sim Gill. He's a 26-year-old. He's been taken into custody, and he faces multiple counts of attempted murder, Dave, and some of these accidents left these women in the hospital with brain bleeds and skull fractures. It just was a horrible ordeal, and it's a miracle none of them got killed.
What made this really impact me is I started to realize how often I just trust the drivers around me to drive legally, to watch out for me, know where I'm at. The idea of someone just targeting, of course, that I would not be prepared at all. They could hit me at any point because I just assume everyone's going to obey the law. So it doesn't surprise me at all that if someone were out there targeting women, that it would be quite easy.
Please send the district attorney, D.A. Sim Gill, joined us yesterday saying that he was driving up and down streets and then he would accelerate. It seemed as though he waited in another case for a couple of women to enter a crosswalk, and then he accelerated and he hit one of them and she landed in the hospital and ended up in ICU.
There was this at times stalking behavior of his targets that he waited and saw them, and witnesses talked about how he would move to one part. And even as we put out in our probable cause statement, the light clearly did not give him the right to go through, but he diverted and accelerated to these women who had every reason to believe in the crosswalk that they were going to be safe.
So this all begins in August. And we know this because police have filed charges and they've spelled out, you know, when the first incident happened, the first crash happened in August. And then it goes on and on. A couple happened in February. Then a couple more in March. They finally take the suspect into custody in mid-March. And the question now that KSL 5 television Sarah Park has been asking is, what in the world took so long to connect all of these cases, Shara, when it's clear from what we know from police, the same type of car was identified in each one of these cases? What are you learning?
Okay, well, first of all, I do want to say that once these all started to really come about in February, where we had multiple within several days and weeks, the dots were connected fairly quickly. It's the case we go back to in August that I have a lot of questions about. I've submitted an open records request to Salt Lake City Police to find out. At that point, that August of last year, they had a woman hit, they had two witnesses at the scene, and they had a license plate, and they identified the driver. And so they had a lot of information. What I want to know at this point, you guys, is where did that go? Was that investigation? Did police ever request charges be filed in that case? Because then we jump ahead to February, where it was my friend and her daughter that were hit.
In Sandy,
just about 100 yards away from her house, a couple feet from my house. You know what I mean? Like, it was that case where I found out about that hit and run, and we did the story. And her husband asked me, you know, does anything ever come from these cases? Do they ever track down the driver? Because at that point, Sandy PD didn't really have a solid lead other than maybe a fuzzy photo of white car in the area. But when we look at how many white cars are in the city, There's no way to really pinpoint that at that point. And so I told him, you know, sometimes they do, sometimes they don't. But the key here is to get the information out there and warn others. Debbie and Dave, 4 days later, another woman, two women reach out to us saying, I was hit. Their families reach out, say they were hit, and it sounds so eerily similar to what happened in Sandy. So we do that story, and we contact Sandy PD, and we contact Salt Lake City PD and say, hey, any chance this is the same vehicle, same MO, the driver came up behind them, hit them from behind, left them in the road. And suddenly, and then a week later, another case in Salt Lake City, all the dots started connecting. So a shout out to the police work that happened there in the month of February headed into March as they started to connect the dots. But when we go back to that first case, that's where my questions really lie.
Okay. And the first case happens not in Sandy.
In Salt Lake.
It happens in Salt Lake
City. August 22nd.
So now we have two different police departments
yep.
who have what seem to be cases that might be connected.
Might be connected.
But two totally different jurisdictions. And what we don't know, it sounds like, is were those two jurisdictions, two different police departments, talking to each other?
They were once we started identifying that there were similarities in the cases. So I remember my first call to Sandy PD after the Sugar House. The two women were hit there as they were leaving. I think it was a yoga studio or something like that. And so the question was right away, hey, any chance this is connected to your case in Sandy?
Okay, wow.
And the response was, oh, we don't know. We haven't heard
You're
about it.
You're connecting the dots.
I mean, I think a lot of people
Initially,
were starting to, but yeah, sure. It was simply just following those threads. And you guys, I just really want to praise the women who spoke up, these families
100%.
Who spoke up. You know, a hit and run, just one off here, one off there. They don't, you know, you don't really start to connect those dots. But these women were paying attention and said, this sounds like what happened to me. And you guys, who knows right now how many cases are really tied to this?
That's what I'm very concerned about that. So we look at this gap in this timeline, Shara, the first case happening in August, according to police, and then they jump ahead to several cases, a couple of cases in February and March. Well, what happened? We don't know if those are the only cases yet.
Well, and we've heard from the DA saying that they're looking at multiple cases. So we have the four right now. And then who knows what could come about as police continue to go back over some of these hit and run cases, try to identify the vehicles, find out if it was a white Avalon, and start connecting more dots.
Part of where my mind goes had the fact that these women survived.
Incredible.
Is
my
incredible.
Friend suffered a traumatic brain injury. She had a hemorrhage. She had vertigo, you guys, for about a week where she was throwing up constantly. She was in ICU for 2 days. Her daughter, who was 16, was hit. She hurt her back and her tailbone. Thankfully, they're both okay. But these women, some of these women were critically injured.
Trauma.
Had these women died, we would be looking at serial killer behavior.
Yes.
That's where my mind went. I thought the fact that these women, thank goodness they didn't, but the fact that they survived and that they recovered. I wonder if that was handled differently in any way, because this kind of predatory behavior, it truly feels predatory to me in a relatively small footprint, you know, from Sandy to Salt Lake. That's not a very big footprint. I think it wouldn't surprise me at all if there weren't numerous more incidents that
I
came
out. I think
so.
We heard even just yesterday, we did a report that there was another woman who said, this sounds very similar. You guys are getting emails.
We got a report this morning, a tip, and we reached out to the Salt Lake City Police Department on another, what appears to be a hit-and-run accident, a crash, on March 2nd, which is outside the current timeline that has
but
been...
But what is the timeline at this point?
We don't know.
We don't even know.
Yes.
We don't know.
You guys, just real quick, I know we're short on time here, but... This man is not unknown to police. You guys, we have cases that go back from a theft, a squatting call, a case where he was charged with punching out a UTA train window. The violence here ramped up over years in terms of charges. So he's not unknown to police.
Well, you have to keep us posted. I know
I'm just invested in this. I want to know.
Of course you are. And best wishes to your friend and to all of the women who have suffered trauma and very, you know, traumatic injuries because of this. He is in court today. We will continue to follow this.
We will.
Shara, thank you so much for joining us and bringing us even larger context to this horrible situation that has been going on for months, affecting women all over the Wasatch Front.
Dave and Dejanovic, your morning companions for talk, analysis, and key perspectives on Utah's biggest stories on KSL News Radio.
Dave, the state of Idaho is on damage control patrol after University of Utah's women's basketball coach went public with racial hate crimes that she said chased her team from their Coeur d'Alene hotel during March Madness just last week. So Coeur d'Alene officials start running to media microphones during a news conference yesterday. They are tripping all over themselves to apologize to the Utes. But then the news conference itself gets disrupted, gets cut short, because some far-right activist shows up and starts shouting questions, which is exactly the problem with Idaho.
This is a press conference.
It's press with the media, not with the general public.
I'm in the media.
Well, who are you with? Who are you with?
It doesn't matter.
Yes, it does. You're out of order.
You're out of order. Now, as you said, Debbie, everybody is falling over themselves to apologize to the Utes. Gonzaga, who is the host city, Gonzaga University, they're 35 miles away. They're like, we're sorry. Like, this isn't even in your state. And you're apologizing because everybody is horrified by what happened.
The governor's apologized. Public officials have apologized. The mayor of Coeur d'Alene was at that news conference. He's apologizing. In a moment, we're also going to talk about the FBI involvement and the police involvement now that, thank goodness, the Utes women's basketball coach stepped up and talked about it. Said what happened. She said it publicly, and now it's a national news story. And so the FBI is paying attention, so are the police. But for just one second, I want to step back to last week with the help of KSL News Radio's Adam Small. And in case you missed it, what happened, fortunately, Adam Small fills in those blanks.
The Lady Utes were initially assigned a hotel in Coeur d'Alene, Idaho, about 35 minutes away. KSL.com reports on Thursday the team was headed out for dinner. While they were walking into the restaurant, they say a truck pulled up to them and someone in it shouted the N-word at them. On their way out, just hours later, they say two trucks pulled up this time and someone again shouted that slur. Utah head coach Lynn Roberts called it a distraction and upsetting.
This should be a joyous time for our program. And to have kind of a black eye on that experience is unfortunate.
Gonzaga and the NCAA did help them get a new hotel in Spokane.
And that I was really, really grateful for, that when they felt unsafe, they wanted to move, that everybody said, fine, let's just do it. We'll change where you're at, because if you don't feel safe here, let's move you.
Well,
but that doesn't address the fundamental problem, because there were other teams with other black players in these hotels.
Well, and Idaho has had a racist racism problem for decades, especially northern Idaho. So the idea that whoever decided that they were going to put teams in a Coeur d'Alene hotel, northern Idaho is infamous for problems like this. Now they apparently ran out of rooms, or maybe there's more to the story. We'll figure that out in the Spokane area. But they put them 35 miles away from the actual event. Now, Coeur d'Alene itself is a beautiful part of the country. I don't know how beautiful it is in March. It's a beautiful part of the country in June and July. But there, Idaho is known, northern Idaho specifically, is known for white supremacy. It is known for Aryan Nation ties. And we'll get more into that in just a moment with a retired FBI agent who specifically worked cases regarding these issues in Idaho and in that part of the country. He'll tell us like it is. But the question right now is, was the law broken? Well, before that news conference in Coeur d'Alene got interrupted, the chief of police said, yeah, there's some possible violations here. And he's been involved or gotten the FBI involved too.
There's an Idaho statute regarding malicious harassment. The second one is a disorderly conduct statute. And then thirdly, there is a federal crime based on what actually occurred that evening that might be appropriate.
So what kind of resources are going into this? Nothing unless Coach Roberts brings this up at the press conference. And that's why I think it was so crucial that she called it out. Because it could have been one of those things. And I think many of us have done something similar where something happens and we just dismiss it. We move on. We don't want to address it. But she took the time, the effort. She knew that this was going to be a big deal. And by bringing it up in a national press conference, now it is being addressed.
She's doing what coaches do best, and that's protect their team.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, that's exactly what it couldn't do anything about it in the moment, maybe. Right. Yeah. But did something about it after the fact, and now it's getting national attention, and it's getting the attention of the police department and also the FBI. The chief did say there were 100 people in the vicinity at the time. So they're looking for witnesses, they're looking for surveillance video. We don't know who did this. They haven't caught anybody yet, at least not that we're aware of. But they're looking. They're trying to figure it out. And in the meantime, Idaho officials are, like I said, tripping all over themselves to do damage control because they know they have a problem on their hands. They have an image of racism, and they have a history of racist incidents in that area. So a couple of officials start bellying up to the podium yesterday to start issuing apologies to the University of Utah.
To the young women who endured racial slurs while visiting, I offer my most sincere apology.
And it's about 17, 18 minutes into this news conference from what I could tell. And in true Northern Idaho fashion, somebody who's been labeled a far-right activist by the media in Idaho starts shouting questions and interrupting the news conference. And it ends up shutting down the news conference.
This is a press conference?
It's press with the media, not with the general public.
I'm in the media.
No, well, who are you with? Who are you with?
It doesn't matter.
Yes, it does. You're out of order.
So what is standard for folks that may not know this is when you're at a press conference, if someone asks you who you're with, you just, I'm with KSL. I've answered this question 1,000 times.
A lot of times we wear press badges.
Absolutely. Yeah. So it's very normal. That's a normal question. Hey, who are you with? Sometimes there's press passes that are required to attend a press conference. Sometimes they're just open. I don't know what this situation was, but it is definitely fishy when you're asked who you're with and they say, don't worry about it.
So I started looking into who this was, and a few media organizations reported a name. And so I went and thought, oh, I'm going to look up who this is. And they have a Coeur d'Alene newspaper up there has done a full article on who this individual is in the past. They've done articles on him. And he seems like he's somebody who would show up to a news conference where local officials are trying to issue an apology about, racial incidents happening to the University of Utah women's basketball team and start trying to disrupt the news conference. So, I mean, they've associated with him. He said he was a guy who got suspended from his radio job back in back east for posting a white supremacist video online that caused backlash against the radio station. So this is what we're dealing with in northern Idaho and what the FBI has been dealing with for decades. Now, it's no secret I was a spokesperson for the FBI for a number of years, and Idaho was part of our territory. And northern Idaho was like, oh, not again. Please tell me that this is not happening again. Because the history of racism, the history of white supremacy in this part of the nation has been going on long before the women's basketball team from the University of Utah showed up to play in what should have been the best game of the year, March Madness. What could be better? But then this happens. We're going to get a former FBI agent who I worked with when I was at the FBI, who worked this area, who knows what goes on there very, very well. He'll tell us the history of Idaho next.
Dave and Janovic.
Decades before University of Utah's women basketball team showed up in Coeur d'Alene, Idaho, the Aryan Nation settled there. The founder of the Aryan Nation settling in northern Idaho. And northern Idaho has been a bed of white supremacist rhetoric, threats. And I am so glad that the women's basketball coach from the University of Utah spoke out about what happened to her team as they were walking back or walking to dinner last week during the March Madness tournament, because they were put in a hotel in Coeur d'Alene, Idaho, 35 miles from where they were playing.
You know, and you have people say, man, I can't believe that happened. But, you know, racism is real and it happens. And it's awful.
Now, Spokane, Washington, which is the home of Gonzaga University, that's where John Stockton played. So that's largely where we know Gonzaga from, has a very rich history in basketball, both men's and women's. So it's not totally uncommon for teams to stay in Coeur d'Alene, Idaho. It's only 30 minutes away, 35 minutes away from Spokane, Washington. Spokane's, you know, fairly small. So if you have a tournament, you're hosting a lot of teams, it's not totally weird to stay in a somewhat adjacent place. The fact that it's in a different state is kind of funny, but yeah, Spokane's right on the border. But when you look at Coeur d'Alene's history, as you were saying, Debbie, this goes back to the 70s, this kind of white supremacy.
And you look at, it's not only... You know, Coeur d'Alene is 35 miles by freeway, by highway to get to Spokane. And Spokane has had its share of problems, too. Bomb blasts, a bomb planted on a parade route a couple of years ago. 12 years ago now, 2011, during the Martin Luther King parade. Both cities share... an infamous history of white supremacy and problems. But northern Idaho, Greg Rogers, retired FBI agent, when I was a spokesperson, you were working a lot of cases up in Idaho for the FBI, and I was a spokesperson at the time, and I'd honestly want to pull my hair out, because this area of the country and of our area itself, of our jurisdiction, was such a problem with white supremacy, with racism, with people that just espoused these very faulty and disgusting beliefs.
Yeah, I spent a lot of time in Coeur d'Alene, and unfortunately there are still a number of very active militia groups. The Aryan Nations there, thankfully, is Richard Butler, who founded it, died in the early 2000s. And the Southern Poverty Law Center was successful in a very, you know, good lawsuit and seized all their property and sold it to satisfy a judgment. So they're gone. But, you know, the remnant of the Aryan Nations and militia groups are still very active in that area.
Greg, when you talk about the militia groups, could you paint a picture? Are we talking about large groups? What do they do? How do they live?
They essentially train in these paramilitary groups. Some of them are, you know, they're not very large. Most of them have the groups that I infiltrated had, you know, 10 members, 15 members. There would be conferences where hundreds of them would show up from Idaho, Montana, Utah, and, you know, bring all of their members. But, you know, most of them have jobs. They have a lot of them were, quite frankly, a lot of them were truck drivers. But they have, you know, they have jobs outside of their militia because the militias don't generate any income. But they are, you know, they're just anti-government groups that are also largely white supremacists. And they're still very, unfortunately, very prevalent in that area. To be brutally honest, though, Coeur d'Alene kind of gets a bad rap. It's not, Coeur d'Alene is sort of like Park City is to Utah. Coeur d'Alene's a very liberal city for Idaho. It's very high-end resort community, very expensive. The militia guys and the Aryan Nations guys, when they were still prevalent up there, couldn't afford to live in Coeur d'Alene. So they lived outside of Coeur d'Alene in cities like Hayden Lake and Rathdrum. But they do come into Coeur d'Alene all the time because that's where, quite frankly, that's where Home Depot, Walmart, that's where all, you know, they come into town for those things and to go to downtown Coeur d'Alene, which is where the basketball team was. The team was in a really nice hotel that's called the Resort right on the lake. It's actually beautiful. Yeah. And you can walk right from the resort to downtown, which is what they were doing. And so, unfortunately, some of these knuckleheads were down there and saw them.
So, Greg, just in the next 2 minutes that we have, describe for us when you were an agent working cases up there with the FBI, what kind of rhetoric would you hear from these individuals, or what are they known for?
They're fundamentalist. The Aryan Nations groups and the remnants of those were Christian fundamentalists that were very racist. I mean, if you weren't, you know, it was white supremacy to an extreme. They wanted to establish and still did talk about establishing a white homeland, which would include several states. They wanted to run out, not just, you know, when white supremacy to the Aryan Nations and their progeny wasn't just against it was against any minorities, any and all minorities. So if you weren't white, they wanted to run you out of their homeland, which they had hoped was going to include Montana, most of the Pacific Northwest. So it was, you know, it was nonsensical. These people are, quite frankly, not deep intellects. And that's what happened. So when some of them were driving around in downtown Coeur d'Alene, and they, which is a really small area, and they saw the basketball team, they just couldn't resist spouting their racist nonsense because that's what they do.
Greg Rogers, thank you for joining us. Retired FBI agent, worked cases in Idaho. Sounds like you know Coeur d'Alene very well. So thank you, Greg, for your expertise.
Yeah, thanks, Greg. Always good to talk to you. Appreciate your perspective. And I know you worked those cases for many, many years. So very familiar with that area. The FBI said to be involved, according to the Coeur d'Alene chief of police. He said he's also investigating. But they're looking for witnesses. They said they're looking for surveillance. to corroborate the allegations that have been made. They're on the case. Whether something comes of the case or not, well, remains to be seen. But again, I'm glad that the basketball coach spoke out about this. It should never have happened. It's unfortunate, Dave. I think you said it best. This should have been the best time of the year for Utah's women's basketball.
Yeah, at the best, it was a distraction. At the worst, they feared for their safety.
They moved hotels.
They moved.
They had to move hotels. Next, we're going to talk about a growing hack. I think this could help homeowners afford a bigger mortgage payment. Would you have a perfect stranger live in your home? Not only live in your home, but sleep in the room next to yours just to make a few hundred extra bucks a month?
Dave and Dejanovic, your morning companions for talk, analysis, and key perspectives on Utah's biggest stories on KSL News Radio. Priced out. Housing. Special coverage with Dave and Dejanovic.
Let's talk about a growing trend. It is called house hacking. And as always, we love the fact that the Stern team has teamed up with the Dave and Dejanovic show over the next year to bring you housing coverage. I mean, housing is such an important issue. It is a huge part of our economy and out of our lives. So if we can find a hack to make your mortgage more affordable, you bet we're going to talk about it.
I love this story so much. I love hacks in general, life hacks. I'm all for them. But this is one, I'm surprised more people don't take advantage of this.
Have you? Do you know what it is? Let me tell you what it is. You rent a room. You rent one room in your house. And Zillow reports, according to these housing trends, this is last year's information. Of course, data is always a little bit behind, but more than half of millennials, 59%, and 54% of Gen Z buyers say it's highly important to be able to rent out their entire home in the future. But in the meantime, even renting a room to make a little extra money is the direction that more homeowners are going for. Would you?
I love this. Yes, I would. First of all, absolutely I would. Number one, we've all done it. We've all gone to college. We were paired with somebody we've never met before. Mm. We either hated them, we loved them, we were indifferent toward them. But the reason we did it is because we couldn't afford to live on our own. So we live in a dumpy old apartment complex or the dorms. We do it because that's what we can afford. Some of these dorms, it was like, here's a dorm and here's four beds in one room with a small little table. Like it was medieval. It was just terrible living. But we did it because that's what you can afford.
As you get older, according to Zillow, this becomes less attractive of an option.
Of course.
So boomers, 59 years of age and older. By the way, I'm not quite there. I'm close, but I'm not quite there. Only 4% are interested in that as a source of a little extra income. And in a moment, I'm going to tell you how much you can earn. We've done some price shopping on renting a room in Salt Lake County and in Utah County up to Ogden. So we've kind of covered lots of areas of the Wasatch Front just to get a good idea of how much it would cost or how much you would earn if you just rented one room. So that in just a moment. Boomers, 4% are interested in it or have done it. Gen Xers, 44 to 58 year olds. This is your age group, Dave. 36%.
So more than a third.
That's actually my age group too.
You're
only
a Gen
57.
Xer.
I'm only 57. I feel older than that sometimes though, but that's okay. We'll talk about that in
another episode
of Dave and Dejanovic. Millennials, 55% want the opportunity to rent out a room. And then Gen Zers and are at about 51%. So millennials and Gen Zers really do lean into it.
If I had my preference, of course, I would live all alone.
You would?
Just by myself.
Why?
Right?
You don't want the income?
No. if money weren't the option,
I see.
I would love to. Like, that would certainly be my preference. But if it's the difference between me owning a home and renting, absolutely, I make this decision.
So this is something you could talk to your kids about.
Oh,
your 20-something-year-old kids, they're not in their own home yet.
No. They have 2 bedrooms in their apartment right now. They totally could.
So they could sublease.
They could sublet it, yeah. Absolutely, they could. Yeah, they could do it. And if you can make, you know, several $100s, so let's just pick a number out of the air, $500. That's the equivalent of working 25 hours at a $20 an hour job.
I hadn't thought of it that way.
So that's an important part of it for me. If I look at it and I say, okay, I'm about $500 a month short of being able to afford this. Do I want to go out and get a part-time job where I'm working 25 hours a month?
That's a great point. Now, for somebody,
which is the sacrifice you'd rather have?
I look at it more like this. If I were going to do this and earn $500 a month, now, I would claim it on my taxes. I wouldn't mess around with trying to get money under the table because the IRS will catch you. It's income. But let's say you charge $500 or $600 a month and you take 20% of that, 25%, whatever, 30% for taxes. So you're netting maybe $400 a month. That to me would be, for my single life, my awesome single life, would be groceries and gas money for the month. Yeah. Think about that. That makes it real. That would cover my grocery tab and my gas, my filling up my tank. Because I pay about $75 a month right now to fill up my tank because I've got that hybrid that's just phenomenal on gas mileage. And, you know, it's lunch and dinner for one.
Yeah.
So there I've got, right there. You know, I've got
you're
I've
making
got that
the
covered.
Math work, Deb.
I'm mathing the math.
You're mathing the math, and it's working.
So let me tell you how much you can earn, according to what our producers, our D2 research department went to work looking at the cost of or the money that's being collected by landlords who rent out one room in their house. You're still living in the house, so you basically have a roommate now.
Yes.
Salt Lake County, we found one in Mill Creek for $670 a month. Plus, you put another $50 a month on this property toward utilities. Let's go down to the Orem area. A private room goes for about $550 a month. You share a bathroom and utilities. Girls only. Only females allowed. So that might be a home that's being shared by college students. But we looked a little deeper and we found that most in Utah County are going in the Orem area going between $500 and $600 a month. How about Kearns? $600 a month. Pleasant Grove, $650 a month down in Utah County. So you got Salt Lake County and Utah County. So you're right in the, let's say $500 to $650 a month. Ogden, you're right about the same for one room.
Do you want me to rock your world? We're out of time. Okay.
What?
Are we going to continue this?
Yes.
Okay. I've got.
Well, you can't just say that and be like, okay. Show's over. We're going home.
This is so good.
World.
Okay.
Why don't you rock my world in 3 minutes?
Okay. In 3 minutes, I'm going to tell you, if you take that $500 and you apply it to the principal of your home mortgage.
Oh, this is going to get good.
What that does, how many years, plural, years you can shave off.
Okay, I love it, Dave. And let's also take your phone calls live, 801-575-TALK. Would you rent a room to a perfect stranger?
You're going
to
do this by April. You're going to have a roomie.
Yeah, to bring in more income. Why not? 801-575-TALK, 801-575-TALK. If you don't like the idea, we'd love to hear from you on that, too.
Dave and Dujanovic. Priced out. Housing. Special coverage with Dave and Dujanovic.
You know, we team up with the Stern team. They've been great to work with for our housing coverage. And this Zillow report caught our eye. It says that house hacking and interest in it has exploded recently, especially among the younger generation. And what house hacking is you rent out a room. You just rent out a room, perfect stranger. You put your room in your home up for rent. You take phone calls, and then you pick somebody from the probably hundreds of calls that you're going to get, and then you charge them $500 to $600 a month. At least that's the going rate that we found along the Wasatch Front.
It seems like a slam dunk. And I told you I wanted to push you with two hands into this life hack. If you take that $500, so say you're in a home, and you can take that $500 for renting out your room, and you apply that directly to your mortgage, it goes directly to principal. Do you know how much you can save? It will cut your 30-year mortgage down 13 years.
That's incredible.
13 years. If you're applying $500 extra a month, you will save over $61,000 in interest over the life of the loan.
We asked for phone calls. Would you do it? Maybe you're more interested in doing it now that you've heard what Dave's said about it. Slicing that much time
13 years
off your mortgage is
you're
incredible.
Down to 17 years on a 30-year loan. You're paying it off in 17 years.
Give us a call, 801-575-TALK. Let us know. Would you do it? Would you rent out a room in your home to a stranger to make extra income every single month?
You're sacrificing privacy. You're sacrificing convenience.
Sure.
I get it. But holy cow, you want to talk about a way to earn wealth? This seems like a slam dunk.
Aaron and Logan, you think that this might bump up against some problems with insurance coverage?
Well, I'm an insurance agent, and I just wanted to point out that sometimes homeowner policies can have exclusions for subletting or, define that you're not allowed to do that. So if you don't check with your insurance agency, that could just invalidate your homeowner policy if you're caught doing that and it's left out of your policy.
Yeah, and especially if something happens and they file a claim.
Yeah.
Like if they slip and fall on a grape in the kitchen and they hit their head and now you've got a claim. I mean, if you think about all of the...
Exactly.
I used to be a landlord. I'm also a mom of three, so I know anything can happen at any time inside a house. But so do you think shopping around, if your insurance policy forbids that, there is an option to maybe go out and find another insurance policy, though, right?
Sure, absolutely. There's so many different options available, and a lot of times people aren't even aware of, the options that they do or don't have. So it's absolutely a great idea to shop around. My company is kind of exclusionary when it comes to things like that, but there's lots of nationwide companies that have absolutely no problem with it.
Thank you for your call. Hold the line. We're going to get, when your call comes through, we can't grab phone numbers. So I'm going to ask our producer, Caitlin, to grab your number. So when we talk about all things insurance in the future, we can give you a phone call and see if you'll join us with some questions that we have.
I also think, and it was interesting when you were describing which generation would be most comfortable, Gen Z, Millennials, they were over 50% said they would feel comfortable doing this. But the baby boomers, the fixed income crew, what was the number?
3%?
4%.
And if they've been in a home for a long time, they might not need the extra.
I will say this, though. I can see a great value if you're a baby boomer, if you're on a fixed income and money is tight, and maybe you own your home and you have, like, I think of my mom's house right now. She's the only one that lives in it. She's got four rooms. She could have three roommates. She could be.
You got to ask Grandma Barb if she'd be willing to
Grandma
do that.
Grandma Barb is super social butterfly. She would love it.
Milo, you don't like the idea. It sounds like you're being comfortable with it.
Yeah, I would be uncomfortable having a stranger stay in my house, especially since I have kids. And then if things go bad, I mean, they have more rights on their end because of squatter rights. So they could say they could 1 month they pay, but then. Imagine how long it takes to get them out if they get so comfortable, too.
You got it. My view, just being previously a landlord, you got to have a lease agreement. You got to have something written in firmly in place that everybody signed and making sure that your rights are protected because you are basically a landlord at that point.
But even then, evictions are messy.
Yeah, it's messy. Yeah. I've been down that road. It's messy. Kendall and Murray, have you done this before?
I have, I use it. Yeah, it's been very successful. I rent out to traveling nurses, And typically they'll rent for anywhere from 30 days to as much as 6 months. And a background check, everything's great.
Can we be rude and ask you kind of like, you knew I was, Dave knew I was going in for the, I was leaning in for the uncomfortable question, as I like to do. How much a month you make?
I do the primary bedroom because I like to have their own private bathroom, and it's $1,100 a month.
Oh!
Kendall, you're an inspiration. What are you? Okay. Kendall, there's about 50 things that I love about you right now. Number one, you're sacrificing the best room in the house, and you're pulling $1,100 out of that. That to me, this is the problem. We complain so often about what we don't want to do, and what we're not willing to do, and we don't want to have a stranger living. Well, look what the benefits are. How much of a game changer would $1,100 a month be
you
for
do the
you?
Math and you're, do the math in your mortgage calculator.
If $500 saves you 13 years on a 30-year mortgage, does it just double it? I'm sure the math, the amortization schedule is far more complicated.
But if you put all of that money.
Right?
Yeah.
I mean, think about it. If you're 10 years, mortgage. That's $120,000 plus.
Alexi, our producer, you're a millennial, right?
I'm Gen Z, I think.
Oh, my goodness. I can't keep you all straight.
That's okay. It's confusing.
But you've rented. You have been a tenant in one of these situations,
yes,
where you rented a room. How much? In Solly County?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, in Liberty Park area.
And?
For $600 a month.
$600 a month. How did that go, just generally for you?
I want to say that I'm still a believer in this idea. I think it's a great idea. But I had, unfortunately, a bad experience with this. I would do it again, but I would be more careful with looking for good and landlords who actually want to take care of their place. Because my problem was that the landlord, quote unquote, the homeowner, was living in the home with me and a couple other people. And there was like something wrong with the house. Our utilities were always $130 a person every month.
Wow.
Which, like, four people in the house, something's wrong.
No way.
And so we would complain and nothing would get done. He didn't really have a responsibility to take care of anything
because
he wasn't the homeowner. Really, yeah, he basically was a homeowner and he didn't really have any obligation to do that kind of stuff like a maintenance man or an apartment building manager would or something like that.
So even though you had a bad experience with it, you're still open to the idea you would just be a little more selective?
Oh, yeah. Well, I think it changes if they don't live in the house with you. If someone rents out like a house that they're not living in, they do have more of an obligation to take care of it. Mm-hmm. But when somebody is renting out like an upstairs room and he lives downstairs, like I was.
That's a twist.
It's a twist. It's a different.
And a dynamic, and it feels uncomfortable.
Yeah. Legality.
Like, look, fix the air conditioning unit, but you're there in the kitchen with the guy, you know, as opposed to dealing with a landlord over the phone. Mm-hmm. Well, thanks for sharing your experience. Yeah. And it was what, $600 a month?
$600 a month.
Plus utilities.
Plus utilities.
Wow. Yeah.
Can I go back to the travel nursing thing?
Quickly.
Like, how often are they even there? I know travel nurses. They work like 80 hours a week.
Straight ahead, Boyd is going to take us to Washington, D.C., where several members, Republican members of the House of Representatives have recently like just quit. They're done. What is going on?
It is the worst year of the 9 years and 3 months that I've been in Congress. And having talked to former members, it's the worst year in 40, 50 years to be in Congress.
Dave and Dejanovic, your morning companions for talk, analysis, and key perspectives on Utah's biggest stories. On KSL News Radio. Dave and Dejanovic have inside sources.
Republicans are having an issue keeping people in Congress. Oh, look at that. I just made Boyd smile. It was not, a couple weeks ago that Representative Ken Buck said this.
It is the worst year of the 9 years and 3 months that I've been in Congress. And having talked to former members, it's the worst year in 40, 50 years to be in Congress.
Yeah, and he left. He's done.
He's not alone. Lots of people are leaving. A lot of different reasons they're leaving. A lot of it is job satisfaction. Boyd, If I'm being totally honest, I don't have a lot of patience for this.
Yeah, and it's an interesting thing because it's the Republicans have some big problems with people running for the doors, and so do the Democrats. The Democrats have lost not only lost people completely leaving Congress, but also just people leaving the party and becoming independents in there. And so both sides are clearly not doing a great job of retention when it comes to their members. But you can hardly blame them. It is such a paralyzed Congress right now that very little work is being done. A lot of people are asking themselves the question, can I make a difference here? Or am I better off doing something else?
How many Republicans have left Congress? Because I think this is where it really matters for the Republican Party, and I think where people in Utah would be interested, because they hold the majority.
Yeah.
But the majority has been getting chipped away little by little. So
right.
This does matter in a big way for the Republicans because they don't want to lose that. So
what
are we looking at?
So you're actually down to, with the representative from Wisconsin announcing that he's leaving this week, the majority for the Republicans in the House will be – one. It will be one.
Everybody's showing up, right? Everyone's showing up.
And so, to Dave's point, that really becomes an issue. If somebody is sick, if somebody has a family emergency, I mean, that happens all the time. You're talking about 435 members in the House, 100 in the Senate. And so there are illnesses. There are family situations that come up and members miss. And with such slim majorities in both houses of Congress, it becomes a big deal pretty fast.
I remember Representative Dan Crenshaw got just blasted for leaving because he used to be a Navy SEAL. Anyway, he went to a funeral of a Navy SEAL and missed a vote, and people were up in arms.
Yeah.
And that was with a fairly, at least a handful of a majority. But to your point, it doesn't allow any wiggle room.
Yeah, there's no wiggle room. And really, in either chamber, Chuck Schumer has the same problem in the Senate when it comes to the Democrats, because it is a small majority. And so everyone's got to show up. And sadly, there's far too many members of Congress who've become very comfortable missing votes. I think the only person you can really point to as the diehard, always in attendance, is Susan Collins, who hasn't missed a vote, I think, in like 30 years.
Wow.
So let's get to the fix. As Representative Ken Buck was leaving Congress, returning to Colorado, this is what he said on CBS.
In Colorado, we have largely moved to a one-party system, and we can see what happens when there is little balance in government. I fear that happening in the federal government.
Where he says Republican leaders are focused on personality over principles.
We're so concerned with who has more Instagram followers. It's crazy.
He doesn't just hint. He flat out says, basically says, like, it's just gone to the internet. I mean, it's
no
about sound bites and who can get headlines
right.
on Instagram and Facebook.
Yeah, it's all performative politics. There aren't a lot of serious policy makers anymore. Of course, we have Utah Senator Mitt Romney, who's stepping down at the end of his term this year, much, I think, for the same reasons of, look, I can make a difference in a lot of other places, so why hang out with the crazies who are getting all the attention and preventing real work and real policy from being done?
This is what frustrates me when you call them, whether it's the flat forehead society,
yeah.
The ones that are just pounding their forehead because they're so frustrated. Listen, the solution, you may think there are solutions mm-hmm. elsewhere, but you ran for this office. Mm-hmm. You had people that gave up their vote to you mm-hmm. to represent them.
Yeah.
It is a sacred duty that you don't get to leave. I'm sorry. Barring absolute catastrophe, you don't get to leave. I gave you the health and the welfare of my family. It is your duty and responsibility to stay and make it work. And if it doesn't work, then you keep trying.
Yeah. And so really interesting. I think it's an important clarifier there, Dave, is that the vast majority of these that are leaving at the end of their term.
Yes.
So most of them are just saying, I'm not signing up for another tour of duty.
Yeah.
And so that's one thing. I completely agree to your point. You sign up for the job unless there's a real shift in family health, mental health, whatever it may be, then that's a little different animal. But those who are just a little tired, that doesn't quite cut it, because you knew what you were signing up for, although I think most people don't realize how painful it's going to be. Running is great.
What do we think of this? Alaska Senator Lisa Murkowski came out. She's a Republican. Mm-hmm. Came out and suggested that she won't rule out becoming an independent. Arizona Senator Kyrsten Sinema left the Democratic Party, a year ago or so, to become an independent. Murkowski from Alaska, been there a long, long time, I think since the early 2000s, saying, I'm not going to rule out becoming an independent, citing, you know, the party's allegiance to Donald Trump as a reason.
Are you considering being an independent at this point?
Oh, I think I'm very independent-minded.
officially, I just
regret that our party is seemingly becoming a party of Donald Trump.
Yeah. You becoming an independent caucusing with Republicans, is that something you're open to?
I am navigating my way through some very interesting political times. Let's just leave it at that.
She didn't say no. But what do we think about us party swapping because of, you know, one party leader or another?
I mean. Yeah. And so let's look at those. So Kyrsten Sinema and Senator Murkowski. So one left the Democratic Party, became an independent, right. Kyrsten Sinema. She still caucuses with the Democrats. So she still, as far as committee assignments and who's in power, in other words, who's the majority in the Senate, she still caucuses with the Democrats. Lisa Murkowski actually had to run as an independent in Alaska 1 year because she lost in the Republican primary, went as an independent, still won, and then came back to the Republican Party. So Lisa Murkowski's sort of been across that spectrum before, and she is very independent.
Isn't she one of the only write-in candidates in the nation
to ever win? A statewide office, yeah, as a senator.
It's incredible.
Senator.
So she's obviously quite popular if she can get enough Alaska residents. I don't know, all 10 of them. I know. Is that the same thing, though, as party swapping, the same thing as just totally leaving Congress?
Yeah. There's not as much. I wish there was actually more of that. And, of course, you have Bernie Sanders, who is an independent, caucuses with the Democrats. What I would love to see is all of those independents get together and form an independent caucus. Because guess what? They'd be the majority. And then everything would change.
That's intriguing. Yeah.
But that takes some real political courage because you would be putting yourself at great risk in terms of re-election. But again, if you're going to be exhausted, exasperated, and leave at the end of your term anyway, this is something I think is worth taking a swing at.
I would like to just see from Republicans and Democrats, I'd like to see them vote against their party every once in a while. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's become such a rubber stamp party at this point, you know, and any time somebody does dare have the audacity, like Mitt Romney, to go against the party and say, you know what, I think Donald Trump is problematic, then he's the rhino. Then everybody is freaking out, whereas I think you've got 100 senators. You're telling me every single one of them is in lockstep with the party in that direction, and every single Republican is the same way. I'm like, I just don't buy it.
Yeah, and it's really interesting. If you actually go look at the vote numbers, they will surprise you. So Mitt Romney voted with Donald Trump far more than Utah Senator Mike Lee did. Pretty interesting. So when you talk about those that are kind of in lockstep or rubber stamp, and there's same things on the Democratic side.
Right.
There's some people like Dick Durbin who you'd say, oh, he's like hardcore Democrat. He votes against his party all the time. You've got guys like Senator Lee and I'm trying to think who's it, Cory Booker, who often end up voting the same on a lot of the things around judiciary. And so you kind of have to dig into it a little bit in terms of how often it is lockstep. The lockstep stuff we see is the big stuff, is the big political stuff, the big political stuff, because that's where everyone is afraid. And what they're afraid of, those who want to stay, they're afraid of losing. And so they want to do what the party bosses want them to do. Those who are independent and who are less worried about staying, guys like Joe Manchin from West Virginia. So he's a Democrat, but he'll look at the Democrats and say, you think I'm selling my soul for that? This is not the greatest job I've ever had. And he's willing to do that. So you have people on both sides of the aisle that do that pretty regularly. We just don't hear about it nearly as much, nor do we hear about the bipartisan work that actually does get done. And there are great people on the right and the left and the left and the right and the middle who do some really important things. We tend not to hear a lot about it, though.
But how often do those go through the House, the Senate, and then end up on the president's desk? Boyd, thank you. I love it. Great conversation. This segment of the Dave and Dujanovic Show is brought to you by Window World. Replace your windows and doors without the hassle or baloney. Call Window World of Utah today.
USA Today published an article that says that Utah is the most affordable state in all of the nation to live. Personally, I don't buy it. And I think it's an important conversation to continue with Luz Escamilla. She's the minority leader of the Utah State Senate. Let's ask her what she sees with her own constituents. Does she feel and do her constituents feel like Utah is the most affordable place in the nation to live?
Dave and Dujanovic.
Let's get to our top local story once again.
Dave and Dujanovic. Special coverage of the top local story.
And I actually thought this was a joke when I first heard it. Turns out it's not. USA Today publishes an article that says Utah is the most, not one of the most affordable place in all of America to live. I don't buy it.
And I am not totally surprised. Now, there's a few caveats here that are important, and it's important to lay this out. Number one, Utah makes good money. In fact, the median income in Utah is $89,000. That means half of Utah makes more than 89 and half make less. I in no way want to diminish those that are making less. Times are tough. Budget is tight. I absolutely understand that. But I think I was surprised that if you're looking around Utah, about half or almost at six figures or better.
But my mind goes to houses are so expensive. Gas is creeping back up again. Daycare. The cost of daycare for families, that's been something that State Senator and Minority Leader of the Utah Senate, Luz Escamilla, has been working on, and she's joining us live on the line. You're trying to make daycare more affordable, and I just know that's just one of the many issues that are facing Utah families. What are you seeing? Do you feel like Utah is the most affordable place in all of America to live, and how do your constituents feel, and what are they feeling?
Well, thank you, and good morning. And definitely, I don't think, and at least in my district, I don't think my constituents agree with USA Today. And in fairness, I think it's important to see what were the expenses that USA Today was looking into, right? Because they were not considering childcare or the fact that you have two parents in the household in the workplace, where Utah continues to be the state with more women in the workplace because of need. I mean, they're picking up all those part-time jobs. I mean, my district, most of our families have 2 to 3 jobs just to barely make it. So I think it's, they were looking into FICA contribution, homeowner costs, groceries, and healthcare costs. We do have a lower healthcare cost. We have a more younger population, healthier population. That certainly reduces some of the healthcare costs compared to other states. We also have a very large healthcare, a healthcare group here that's a nonprofit. So, I mean, I think some of those factors, but the reality is, and maybe this gives us an opportunity to talk about a couple of things. One, Utah is a growing and very strong economy, and we are very happy for that. But you do have the vast majority of our working families struggling to be, especially our younger families, to buy their first home. So the state legislature and, state government has been pushing some first home buyer pieces. But, I mean, childcare, I have to tell you, is the number one issue for women when you start talking to women in the workforce and families in general. And we haven't done anything. So I think childcare has become more and more expensive in the state of Utah when you talk to families. And food insecurity. I mean, groceries overall are more expensive, but also how many families in our state do not know where their meal will come this evening is 1 in 10. So those numbers continue to be increase, unfortunately. So there may be other components that are helping our state, and we need to continue to be positive, but we also want quality of life for all Utahns.
Senator Luz Escamilla joins us right now, and in part when I looked at this, I thought what's important is the debate is not necessarily, hey, is is everything affordable here in Utah? It really is, comparatively speaking. If we were to look at other states, and if you think it's bad here, wait till you see gas prices in California. Is there a state that you look at and say, you know what, they have absolutely hit this nail on the head, we should follow this example? Is there something that pops into your mind?
I think it depends on the issue, and you're absolutely correct. And we are in Utah because we love living in Utah, right? And people are moving. We have tons of migration to our state, and, you know, people may feel different about those levels of migration, but the reality is we have a strong economy, meaning there's jobs, and we have almost a non-unemployment rate, right? Lower than, we're hitting the 2%.
Yeah.
That's a great place from an economic perspective. Businesses love to do business in Utah. Our education is doing better, but we still have tons of kiddos. So I think what we need to define, and to answer your question about best practices in other places, depends on the issue. I think Utah can be, definitely be that holistic, you know, comprehensive place to create that quality of life, because we have the outdoors, we have a beautiful place that we live, but we still struggle with air quality, for example, right? Specific areas have a bigger problem with air quality, and we have to address emissions. So let's work on that. Childcare, I will say, to me, is the number one issue for working families, and we need to do something. It's now people are spending more, almost 20 to 30% of their income on childcare. And if you add that to your now rent or housing cost, it's impossible to get to buy your first home for many of those young families. So when you see that overall picture is what we need to focus and really think about how, you know, for some of these families, they're literally I've met people who have three jobs just to barely make it. And both parents in the household are both working.
Well, thank you so much for joining us. You articulated so well, Senator, what I was not able to articulate as well as you did. Of course, you've been in the legislature for a very long time, and you're dealing with your constituents who are day to day or just trying to make ends meet. And I have not felt for a long time. I did in the beginning when I first moved here and through much of the 90s that Utah was a pretty affordable place to live, but I have felt over the years that something changed, and it is becoming more and more affordable. So I was absolutely shocked when I heard that USA Today had put us as number one most affordable place to live in the United States. But she brought a much bigger perspective and context to the problems that many Utah families are facing.
And we've had major changes in just the last 5 years. Housing specifically, we've seen home prices increase by 50%, 100% in some cases. So it will be very, very interesting to see what happens in the next 10 years if we play this affordable housing game or affordable Utah all over again.
I think you have to definitely look at daycare costs. You have to look at that when you're considering how much it costs to live in a state, and compare that to what it is in other states. I think you also have to consider, you know, income taxes, whether you collect state income taxes. They don't collect state income taxes or higher taxes with property taxes. So there's a lot that goes into, in my view, deciding what state is the most affordable. I don't feel Utah fits that bill. I hear from too many people. I have, 20-something-year-old kids who are hanging out with 20-something-year-old adults, and I hear their stories. And it is so expensive now for them and the next generation that I can't see us as number one most affordable place in the whole United States. Thank you so much to Minority Leader of the Utah State Senate, Luz Escamilla, for joining the conversation. Straight ahead, speaking of expenses, Dollar Tree just announced it's raising prices again. Wow. U.S. Transportation Secretary Pete Buttigieg making some remarks right now at the White House regarding the bridge collapse in Baltimore. Moments ago, just saying that six people have died. There's been some questions as to whether the search for the men who were, I believe they're all men, construction workers on that bridge at the time of the collapse at 1:38 yesterday morning. If the search was going to continue or not. Earlier this morning, Dave, we saw that they had resumed the search, although it sounded like even earlier than that, they had called off the search.
Yeah, it really is a rescue situation right now.
Let's go live. Let's take CNN live. Vice Admiral Peter Gautier speaking live right now about it.
While we didn't achieve the outcome that we had hoped for, it was a tremendous team effort in the treacherous operational conditions. As this aspect of the response shift to recovery operations and consistent with the president's direction to get the port up and running as soon as possible, the Coast Guard highest priority now is restoring the waterway for shipping, stabilizing the motor vessel dolly and removing it from the site, and coordinating a maritime casualty investigation under the leadership of the National Transportation and Safety Board. So just a couple of words on each one of those. So in terms of assessing restoring the waterway, the Coast Guard is very tightly connected to the Army Corps of Engineers as they lead in that role.
The Vice Admiral with the U.S. Coast Guard there speaking on what the future holds. So think about this, that cargo ship is blocking the waterway because it, and so is the bridge. So the bridge is destroyed. Cars and cargo cannot go back and forth over that. And that's probably going to take who knows how long to repair. And then also they've got to open up that waterway because clearly, I mean, that cargo ship was transporting something. I don't know that we're clear yet on all of that, what was in the cargo ship, but they've got to get that waterway open, Dave.
And part of the problem is this is a very dirty, hard to see part. It's just dirty. So it's not like you can go in there and see everything. You have to use sonar. You're going to have to remove millions of pounds of bridge and debris that is sitting 40 to 60 feet below the water. So the cleanup on this is almost incomprehensible how large scale this is.
They said they're going to have to use a marine salvage plan and that the United States Coast Guard has members of the Coast Guard on the cargo ship. Let's step back into it live for just a few seconds to listen to what he's saying.
Take the next steps appropriate to refloat the vessel and remove it from that area. The real critical thing here is that, as you know, a portion of the bridge remains on the bow of that ship, and we will be coordinating very closely with the Army Corps of Engineers and their contractors to first effect the removal of that debris before the vessel can then be removed. The vessel bow is sitting on the bottom because of the weight of that bridge debris on there. And there are underwater surveys that are happening by remotely operated vehicle. Divers will be in the water today to complete that underwater survey. There's no indication that there's any flooding or any damage underneath the waterline to that vessel.
So the Coast Guard is just saying that 56 of those containers, according to a graphic I'm reading right now on Fox News, 56 containers have hazardous materials. That's what I wanted to know. What is in those containers? We don't know maybe specifics, but they are carrying hazardous materials. So an already horrible and very precarious situation there in Baltimore gets even more dangerous when you consider that there's hazardous materials on board.
And there are hundreds of shipping containers on this cargo ship. So it is enormously loaded. And because, again, it was just leaving port, the water to the floor is about 40 to 60 feet. And as you heard the Vice Admiral say, the bow of the boat with the bridge sitting on top of it has actually pushed the bow of the boat down to the floor of the river.
Dave, remind me what you learned yesterday about this how that traffic got stopped because of the Mayday alert. Because I learned something more this morning about what may have happened as a result of that Mayday alert. But you were watching the video unfold as this cargo ship was moving at like 8 miles an hour, which I think we figured out would take, what, almost 20 minutes to actually stop it, and then just bashed into that bridge, and then the bridge collapses. But you said you noticed that cars were stopping.
Yeah, I noticed when I was looking through the video, and I'd watched this video a dozen different times, I noticed that right before the collapse, you weren't seeing cars traveling actively across the bridge. And then we learned shortly thereafter that there had been a mayday call, and that the ship had relayed the fact that they were having power issues, that they didn't have control of the ship, that there was a possibility that they would run into the bridge. So they were able to shut down traffic on the bridge.
I heard during Utah's morning news this morning, Tim and Amanda talking about this, and that the governor of Maryland was praising police officers for getting to that bridge in enough time to stop traffic. Wow. I mean, wow. Just another element of, you know, how lives were saved in the moment.
And to give you an idea of how close of a call this was, as I'm watching this video, the collapse of the bridge happened just 33 seconds after the final car crossed the bridge. Wow. 33 seconds.
I want to return now to this live, looks like a news conference. It's not just a address to the nation. Transportation Secretary Pete Buttigieg taking questions. I do want to make it clear that we've just learned from the Vice Admiral of the Coast Guard that those 56 hazardous containers on that cargo ship, he is saying that there is no threat right now. There is no threat to the public. So they look like they feel like they have that situation under control. But let's continue listening to this news conference
so
live.
The infrastructure law did authorize funding into the emergency relief account, which is the mechanism that is most likely to come into play here. Last I checked, there was about $950 million available, but also a long line of needs and projects behind that. So it is certainly possible, I would go so far as to say likely, that we may be turning to Congress in order to help top up those funds. But that shouldn't be a barrier to the immediate next few days beginning to get the ball rolling.
What would be the time frame?
So being asked a question about how the federal government will pay for this, there are infrastructure funds there. You just heard him say they're well over $900 million, but that they would likely have to tap Congress for help.
I just saw the Washington Post just 3 minutes ago posted what it would take to rebuild Baltimore's Key Bridge. The original construction took 5 years to build, and about $316 million in today's dollars. So that was coming from a much different place. You have a massive, and it's going to cost millions and millions, tens of millions, hundreds of millions of dollars just to clean everything up. And then you've got to address rebuilding the bridge.